You are listening to National Security Law Today.
Hi there, listeners. This is Elisa Poteet, the host of National Security Law Today. The reason I'm speaking to you now before our ordinary introduction is that the Supreme Court agreed to hear the Trump case regarding his immunity from criminal prosecution. I'm bringing this to your attention for one simple reason. The ever brilliant Steve Vladeck was our guest the day before the court agreed to this. Just wanted to make sure you had the timing clear in your head as you listen to the ever brilliant Steve Vladeck. Thanks for listening. Welcome to National Security Law Today, the podcast of the ABA Standing Committee on Law and National Security. I'm Elisa Poteet. The Supreme Court is taking up a couple of cases that could have massive consequences for the United States. And of course, there are national security implications for such cases. But I thought it would be a good time to talk to a Supreme Court expert. And naturally, I thought of Steve Vladeck, who is the Charles Allen Wright Chair in Federal Courts at the University of Texas School of Law and a Supreme Court scholar, to be sure. He also co-hosts the podcast, the National Security Law Podcast with Bobby Chesney. And I'm asked by my interns to complain that they are not pumping out enough episodes. Would you please do more?
I'll do my best. Now,
maybe so Chesney's the problem. Is that what you're saying?
I mean, you know, I don't want to throw him under the bus on a recorded podcast, but here I am. Okay.
But he's also got a Substack right now, One First, and you get a lot for free and you get even more if you subscribe. But I will tell you, it's excellent. And he is a high level explainer of things Supreme Court and otherwise. I would suggest you give it a try. Welcome, Steve. Good to have you on NSLT.
Thanks, Elisa. Great to be with you.
Let's just jump right into it. There's a lot going on, not even including the Wagnerian opera that was the argument today regarding state regulation of social media. Let's go back just a bit. Let's start from the beginning. What did these, it's Florida and Texas. What did these laws purport to do?
Sure. I mean, so the laws are very similar. I mean, they have some differences at the margins, but they're both motivated by the same sort of Trump era reaction that big social media companies were unduly censoring conservative content. Both Florida and Texas passed laws that basically require, as a condition of doing business in their states, and actually in Texas's case, even not. If you're a large social media company, there are limits on exactly when and how you can moderate content. And basically, the statutes try to impose on these large social media companies a series of requirements that would make it very difficult for Facebook, for Twitter, for whatever medium is your favorite, basically to regulate content in any way that was dependent upon the actual content of the content. In other words, it would basically say you can have neutral content moderation policies, but you can't, for example, suppress posts that are violent or suppress posts that have misleading information in them or, various other tools that these social media companies have used to, one, enforce their terms of service, and two, try to, at least some degree, mitigate the spread of mis and disinformation.
I think a feature of their argument had to do with also sort of the commercial implications of not being able to regulate things that would cause people to abandon the platform and the like. What happened today? I mean, this was kind of amazing, and it was one of the longest arguments. Am I wrong? I mean, was this... I don't know. I guess I didn't always listen to the feed. You know, they always occurred during the workday, but I must admit this thing went on forever. Was it a record?
It's certainly not a record. You know, in the old days before the Supreme Court had briefs, they would often have days, if not weeks, of oral argument in high profile cases. We got spoiled by the Rehnquist era, when Chief Justice Rehnquist would cut off advocates the second the red light came on. And so you could set your watch to Supreme Court arguments taking exactly 1 hour. Part of what's happened is that starting with the accommodations the court made during COVID, now all of the arguments are running longer, Elisa. But part of it here is that even though these cases raise very similar questions, the court actually did not consolidate the Florida case and the Texas case. So you had back-to-back arguments on what were really the same constellation of questions, which meant that why buy one when you can have two at twice the price? That was today's oral argument.
It was definitely long. And I believe it was Florida first, right? If I recall.
Yep.
Florida went first. And then not only did they hear from the petitioner and respondent, but I think they also heard from Amici. There were, a cast of thousands. It was a Cecil B. DeMille movie in terms of the Amici. But what were kind of the big issues that surfaced? And I'm not saying I was surprised, but there were a couple of things about whether, you know, this was a facial challenge versus mm-hmm. as applied. There were a lot of references to cases where I thought topographically, at least, they were, marginally opposite. And I'd like to kind of get... Yeah. A sense, what would you say were the key sort of takeaways from the argument? What did you observe in terms of which justices honed in on which issues? Because before we started recording, I have to say I was a little surprised.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's worth adding one step of context, which is, you know, the court had already, back in May of 2022, voted 5-4 to put the Texas law back on hold. After the Fifth Circuit in the Texas case had stayed a district court injunction. So, Alisa, in that respect, we already had a little bit of a preview of where at least some of the justices were. And it wasn't just that it was 5-4. It was 5-4 with Justice Kagan joining Thomas Alito and Gorsuch in dissent. So, you know, already we know that the Chief Justice and Justices Kavanaugh and Barrett, probably the three most important votes when trying to handicap these cases, were uncomfortable letting the Texas law go back into effect 2 years ago. Against that backdrop, I will say that, like, I thought today's argument went largely as I might have expected, perhaps other than the very long detour into facial versus as-applied challenges. The basic problem in these cases is that there are these two lines of First Amendment doctrine that don't comfortably or easily fit onto these cases by themselves. And it's sort of, it's a fight between the two sides. The social media companies want one line of cases about, for example, whether Boston had to allow an Irish American parade, right, to also allow in other groups, right? The Hurley case, they want those cases to be the ones that control. You know, Texas and Florida want these other cases, Pruneyard, about the ability of California to, you know, regulate the speech of a shopping center to control. And really, social media doesn't comfortably, obviously fit into either paradigm. And so we're left to some degree trying to figure out which First Amendment principles should govern. At the basic level, the real problem to me in these cases is you have government telling social media companies what they can and can't do with their content. And if Texas and Florida can do that to Twitter and Facebook and Instagram and TikTok, right, to all these other social media companies, can't they do that to grocery stores, right? Can't they do that to, you know, other sort of large commercial providers of important non-governmental services? That's the slippery slope here that I'm not sure Texas and Florida did a really good job of avoiding in the arguments today.
Let me ask you, on that score, there was a detour, at least I wasn't expecting it, about what platforms would be affected. And we veered into a conversation about things like, let's say, Etsy. I wonder if you could explain that aspect of the discussion, because I thought a lot of time was given to that. And I thought, for whatever reason, the justices had focused on it.
One of the places where the laws are not precisely identical is which types of companies they apply to. Keep in mind that both of these cases got to the Supreme Court on preliminary injunction. So there hasn't been this, you know, years-long record-building litigation about the full scope of these statutes and what they would and would not apply to. And so against that backdrop, at least I think part of the concern is, well, where's the line between Twitter and Facebook, which everyone agrees the law applies to, right? YouTube and Etsy or Amazon or other companies that are not principally social media platforms, but that have some kind of interactive capability where all of a sudden it looks like a problem. I will just say, I actually think that's a bad sign for Texas and Florida, that the court is worried about those cases, because it suggests that there's not just sort of direct content moderation problems with these laws, but there's also some issue about vagueness and about sort of how broadly these laws sweep and to which companies they apply. Texas and Florida, one of their strongest arguments in favor of these kinds of laws is that social media companies are unique and ought to be treated as what the law calls common carriers because they provide such important service to the public, because they are an indispensable means of communication. And I'll just say, the more that justices are talking about companies like Etsy, I think the more that's poking a pretty big hole in Texas and Florida's argument, not just because these laws themselves might apply to those companies, but because the First Amendment principles might be, it might be hard to sort of draw the constitutional line where Facebook and Twitter are on the, yes, we can regulate you side of the line and Etsy's not.
What struck you was some of the more interesting questions by the justices today, and were they different in the second part when they were talking about the Texas law than they had been about the Florida law in terms of their focus? And by the way, the thing you mentioned about there not being record building, I believe that was hit on a couple of times about sort of a dearth of a record seemed to be a focus of at least Kavanaugh. Certainly Gorsuch, I thought once. I think I have that right.
Yep. And this is a really sort of interesting problem, at least of this, at least partly of the court's own making. The court has in the last couple of years taken more and more cases at pretty early junctures of litigation. In this context, at the preliminary injunction stage, you know, we've seen a bunch of cases where the court has leapfrogged over federal courts of appeals to do something called certiorari before judgment. You know, last week, the court heard oral argument on these emergency applications respecting the Biden administration's good neighbor plan for ozone pollution standards, where, Elisa, no lower court has yet done anything. And so, you know, whatever folks think the right answers are in these cases, one of the things I think really stood out during today's argument, just like last Wednesday's argument in the good neighbor cases, is the justices' own palpable frustration that they're deciding pretty momentous legal questions. Today, constitutional questions, last Wednesday, statutory questions on, you know, pretty Spartan records in a context in which actually it would be a lot easier to do some of the line drawing it seems like they're struggling to do if there was more of an opportunity for what they call percolation, right? If there was more of an opportunity to have a sense of exactly what these laws do and don't do, as opposed to basically resolving these, in effect, pre-enforcement challenges in a context in which, you know, a lot of what's going on is both the parties and their amici, not necessarily, I mean, speculating, right, trying to sort of project what the effects of these laws are going to be.
So where do you think this ends up?
You know, I will say I was looking for reasons today to not just think that the vote 2 years ago in the emergency application in the Texas case was a harbinger. And I'll say there are two things that I think suggested that that vote may well be a harbinger. The first is, you know, Justice Kagan had dissented 2 years ago, but I did not hear her as an especially strong defender of either Texas's or Florida's laws during either of today's arguments. And there were various points where I also thought Justices Kavanaugh and Barrett both expressed not just a fair amount of skepticism about these laws, but in Justice Barrett's case, a fair amount of sophistication in understanding exactly what the downsides are to what Texas and Florida are trying to do. So, you know, I don't know exactly what the court's going to do. There are two cases. Maybe they try to find a way to rule narrowly in the Texas case, maybe on facial versus as applied grounds, and then more broadly in the Florida case. But on the question of whether they're going to hold that the First Amendment allows Texas and Florida to do what they're doing, my best guess is the answer is going to be at least in some way, no. And, you know, maybe with six or seven justices in that majority.
Yeah, it was interesting. And one of the things that they noted was logistically, how would this work? What would this look like? I mean, would you be geofencing to exclude certain comms in these states? I mean, it sounded like they just didn't like it at all.
And those consequences are a problem because, you know, the Texas law actually would make it a problem even with geofencing, right? And so part of the issue, I think, for the justices is, as with the two cases they heard last year about Section 230 and the immunity that tech companies have under the Communications Decency Act, I think that they sort of are sympathetic to what the states were trying to do. They're wary of the power of big social media companies. But once they're actually all dressed up and the cases are fully briefed, it's not as obvious to them that there's the glaring legal problem that led them to take the case in the first place. So I think we're probably heading for a pretty narrow ruling in both these cases, but one in which the Florida and Texas laws don't survive, at least as applied to the plaintiffs.
Yeah, there was a lot of reference to plainly legitimate sweep. I kept hearing that over and over again. I did find one comment particularly interesting. I just wanted to ask you about, and you may have no opinion or a strong opinion. At some point, I thought I understood Justice Thomas to suggest that somehow advocating for terrorist activity is otherwise punishable in some way. I'm not sure that he intended to say that, but that is sort of what it sounded like he said. And it was that lawful but awful space thing that I thought, am I misunderstanding him? Did you hear that part? And how did you react to that?
You know, I thought that might just have been a somewhat inartful reference to the Supreme Court's 2010 decision in Holder versus Humanitarian Law Project, right, where the court had rejected the First Amendment challenge to the material support statutes insofar as they criminalized providing support, which can include advocacy, right, to designated foreign terrorist organizations. That, if I had to guess, that's where he was going. You know, whether he actually meant to go further, I suspect we'll have to wait and see for if and when he writes separately.
Let's go for just a second. Just generally, what else do you see coming up on the court that you believe in terms of their calendar, their arguments that are going to present concerns for national security? And it's hard to say for me in advance. Like the Texas and Florida law are interesting to me on one level, and that is that there's a lot of congressional inaction, right? Yep. I mean, we hear these hearings, you know, about social media. I think we've had, what, four total, including the one with Francis, and then we had the one on kids. Then social media on average pours in, what is it, $5-6 billion a year in lobbying money, and nothing happens. What do you see? What do you think are the implications, at least national security implications for this case? And what do you see on the agenda, the court's calendar, that is probably something that we need to watch?
So, you know, when it comes to sort of national security and social media, I actually think the bigger case is one the court's going to hear next month, which is a case called Murthy versus Missouri. And this is a case where some sort of anti-vaccination activists and a couple of red states sued a whole bunch of Biden administration officials on the ground that they alleged that the officials were, in effect, censoring their private social media content by jawboning Facebook, Twitter, et cetera, by putting pressure on, you know, the social media platforms to not publish their posts or to depublish their posts, to sort of to suppress their posts. Alisa, that I think has more immediate national security implications because the injunction in that case actually prevents national security officials throughout the executive branch from working with social media companies to take down posts that might actually be direct threats to our national security. That to me is more of a direct national security case that's going to be argued, I believe, March 18th. The court has, in addition to these Trump cases, which are getting so much attention, a bunch of pretty significant administrative law cases about just how much courts will and won't defer to the executive branch when it comes to authorities Congress has delegated to them. None of those cases are directly national security cases, but at least, as you know, so much of what, you know, the Department of Defense does, the Department of Homeland Security does, even the National Security Division, Department of Justice does, the Office of Foreign Assets Control, the State Department, is exercising delegated authorities where some of the statutory terms are ambiguous. You know, what the court ultimately says about Chevron, I think, could have a lot of implications for our field. The future of the administrative state more generally, I think, is going to be a really, really important thing to assess at the end of this term, and it's going to get drowned out by the Trump cases. But, you know, that's, at least from the perspective of our field, that's where I'm really focusing.
All right, that's good to know. But like you did mention Trump, and we can't get away from it right now. We're heading into another election season, and I don't think anybody has an appetite for sort of the acrimony that's about to ensue. But I do wonder, because the court has agreed now to hear Trump's immunity claim, I wonder if you could just educate us generally what the history, if any, is.
So, I mean, the court hasn't agreed yet, right? I mean, so the court is currently sitting on the emergency application in the January 6th prosecution. I think, I mean, there are now basically two cases, right? There's the Colorado ballot disqualification case, in which the court heard oral argument on February 8th. And I think a lot of folks came out of that argument pretty skeptical of the court doing anything to keep former President Trump off the ballot.
Everyone, right? Including Kagan, right? Everybody.
That's right. So I think it's pretty clear that the Supreme Court is not going to disqualify President Trump. But the immunity case, I think, is a bit of a horse of a different feather. So there you had this unanimous, and it's worth stressing, very ideologically diverse panel of the D.C. Circuit rejecting former President Trump's claim that he's immune by dint of his constitutional duties as president from prosecution for the January 6th violence and his role leading up to it. The Supreme Court has not yet ruled on his emergency application to keep that prosecution on hold. My best guess, and it's worth what you paid for it, is that that probably means that one of two things is happening. Either the court's going to deny the application and someone's writing a dissent, or it means that the court might be writing its own opinion that summarily affirms the DC Circuit. Either way, like either of those dispositions would clear the way for, you know, the January 6th prosecution to go ahead sometime this summer. And at least I think from the court's perspective, that would have the, you know, upside of the court having split the difference, right? Of the court sort of not being all the way for Trump and not all the way against Trump. And also the court sort of staying out, like, we're going to let the voters decide whether to vote for him, but we're also going to let these prosecutions go forward in case that influences the voters. Like, I think that could be a very elegant compromise from the perspective of those justices, like Chief Justice Roberts, who actually tend to think about these things in institutionalist terms. You know, it's possible the court's going to do something else with the emergency application in the January 6th case. I just think that the longer that goes on without the court acting, the more likely those two scenarios are the most, you know, have the highest probabilities.
That is good to hear. I know we have you for like 5 minutes, and I think we've now had you for 20. Is there anything else that we should be watching, though, in the federal circuit that you're keeping an eye on right now that you would commend to our listeners to pay attention to? Stepping back from the Supreme Court.
Yeah, I mean, you know, so much of where you stand is a function of where you sit. And I sit in Texas. And I do think that some of the stuff that's going on between the Biden administration and the state of Texas along the U.S.-Mexico border actually has pretty profound national security implications, not just the direct national security implications of our immigration policies and what it means that we're having these upticks in unauthorized crossings, but Elisa, also the long-term implications of some of the legal arguments that Texas is making in these cases. So, among other things, Texas is arguing that what's happening along the border is an invasion for constitutional purposes. That obviously has enormous relevance to national security law and national security lawyers. Texas is arguing that Article 1, Section 10, Clause 3 gives it the right to act in self-defense even when the federal government is on scene and acting in a way that Texas thinks is just inadequate. That would have remarkable implications for the future of, you know, national security law. And in the case about Texas's newest immigration law, SB4, Texas is arguing basically that the Supreme Court's 2012 decision in Arizona versus the United States, the last time the Supreme Court really clarified the relationship between the federal government and states when it comes to immigration law, ought to be revisited. If the Supreme Court were to do that, that would have pretty enormous implications. So, you know, I think there's a tendency on the part of some of us in this field to think that immigration law is over there and national security law is over here. And I really do think that these Texas cases, all three of which are working their way through the courts, one of which has already been to the Supreme Court on an emergency application, two of which could get there in relatively short order. These are cases to keep an eye on, both because of their sort of long-term implications for the balance of power between states and the federal government on things like invasions, and because at least to this point, you know, Texas has been relatively successful in the lower courts on arguments that 10 years ago, I think, would have been just about non-starters. So, you know, at least for me, those are really big cases to keep an eye on.
Well, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to hear from you. I know you're a busy man today. You must be exhausted from active listening to the hours and hours of arguments. We really appreciate it. And by the way, Steve is the author of numerous books. We're going to hyperlink to his bio and some of his publications in the notes to this cast, as well as his Substack. And you know how to find the National Security Law podcast. But if you don't, we'll hyperlink to that. If you have a complaint about the fact that you're not hearing from Steve enough on that, please direct that complaint to Steve.
I'm sure Bobby.
He'll be very happy. Or Bobby, or maybe just Bobby. I don't know what to say. All right. Well, it's been good to have you. Thank you so much for joining us. And
thanks, Lisa.
All right. We're going to pivot now to national security news of sorts. Gosh, there's so much today. But we hope to see you soon.
Thanks. I really appreciate it. Great to be with you.
We're moving on now, ladies and gentlemen, to national security news, which is nonstop. First, some members of Congress are calling for the elite global consulting firm McKinsey to be barred from doing business with the federal government because of its ongoing contracts advising the People's Republic of China. Separately, major newspapers are reporting a massive effort by China to circumvent U.S. tariffs by shipping goods to Mexico and having them shipped from Mexico to the United States. And this is all occurring as the U.S. tries to wean itself off of supply chain dependency on China. In an apparent first, the FTC has banned a U.S. data broker from selling location data of American citizens. And up until this point, the U.S. foreign adversaries could buy any of your data legally and develop that into a usable format, such as determining your pattern of life for counterintelligence purposes. Also, the Senate Select Committee on the Strategic Competition between the United States and the Chinese Communist Party has issued a report, which is entitled Reset, Prevent, Build, a strategy to win America's economic competition with the Chinese Communist Party. The report contains a lot of findings and recommendations, and we will cover that report in detail for you in the coming weeks. And the Delaware Chancery Court has ruled against Elon Musk's compensation package by its board, after which the Mercurial CEO threatened to move Tesla to Texas. Now, why does this matter? Because Musk is the founder and head of several companies on which our national defense has grown increasingly dependent. And we will also have a cast about our dependency on the private sector for our national security and billionaires, Mercurial billionaires and other billionaires, and whether any of this is consistent with U.S. values are in the U.S. interest in the long term. Now, today, as we are recording this podcast, there has been a significant loss in Ukraine to Russia. This has resulted in a lot of loss of life in Ukraine. And at this point in time, we express sympathy to Ukraine, and we sincerely hope that they can keep up the good fight. This is a very tragic day for that part of the world. Now, if you're listening to us tonight, we would ask you to share this episode with a friend, but you should have a thoughtful conversation with your friend about this episode, a conversation in which you can take in other people's opinions and arguments. And that is a good thing because our national security, of course, depends on our unity, but your skills as a lawyer also depend on your ability to understand the other side and prepare a thoughtful reaction. If you want to contact us, you can do so on social media. You can always find us at the handle, which is at ABANatSec. You can send us an email if you choose at nationalsecurity@americanbar.org. Our writer producer is me and host is me, Elisa Poteet, but I'm always here in my individual capacity. Our editor and my co-producer is Francis Burkham. My other co-producer is Holly McMahon, along with all the members of the Standing Committee on Law and National Security, without whom this podcast would not be possible. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.
The views expressed on National Security Law Today have not been approved by the House of Delegates or the Board of Governors of the American Bar Association, and this recording should not be construed as representing ABA policy.